This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thank you very much for coming back on time after lunch. We look forward now to another slant on LICA, beginning with Dr. Philip Jones from the South Australian Museum, looking at the 1938 South Australian Government LICART search party. And of course, this offers another view into this ongoing debate, a very strong debate about what might have happened to Ludwig LICART. And so I look forward to Philip's presentation.
The expedition which occurred in 1938 did come out of the blue, and in many respects it's an oddity, and it's that I want to speak about. Yes, you'll excuse the rather irreverent pouring of some Simpson Desert sand onto the paper there, which is a relic from that expedition, 1938, one of the odd things which was brought back, and which was actually, and I did pour it carefully back into the bottle, which is on display in the museum during the 1940s, and people would have come into the museum and seen this rather homemade exhibition on a very peculiar expedition in August 1938. And I suppose I want to make the point that the story of LICART was in a way coursing through the streets of Adelaide for most of the 19th century, up and down North Terrace. Members of Parliament were also in the Royal Geographical Society. The Royal Geographical Society was one of the key cultural institutions in Adelaide. Members were also in the museum. And so periodically there were articles in the press or scholarly articles published in the Journal of the Royal Geographical Society itself, which dealt with the LICART expedition, and particularly with every now and again the odd piece of intelligence which had come in from the bush, Adelaide being the capital of the bush, as I like to think of it, not so far away from the red sand of the centre. And these rumours would come in, particularly would be discussed at the Black Bull Hotel in Hindley Street, an edifice which still stands, but was an engine room of rumour coming from the bush. And it appears that in early August 1938, one of these rumours sort of spilt, one could say, out of the Black Bull Hotel and found its way into the offices of the Adelaide Advertiser and the News, and then came back along North Terrace through Parliament House down to the museum, where it acquired a certain amount of respectability and found its way back into the newspapers. It hit fertile ground because there had been a range of opinion expressed and documentation relating to sites, including marked trees and other reported events occurring essentially in the Lake Eyre Basin, the drainage system of the Cooper in particular, during previous years. And this was pretty well actually mapped and summarised by Archibald Grenfell Price in the publication which emanated or occurred after the 1938 expedition in the following year, which I think until Darrell's synthesis probably stood as the best summary of the progression of inquiry, rumour and scholarship which had marked the LICART story. And I include this here because it gives you the letter L essentially in pretty well in the centre of the map, let's see, just there, which is the source of the rumour which became acted upon within an astonishingly short period in early August 1938. This rumour was reported in this way in the Advertiser. And this is a page from Mountford's journal of the 1938 expedition. Now, I was hoping that would be big enough for me to read. It isn't, but luckily I made a transcription. And I want to read this to you because it really gives you the flavour of what was believed and what impelled the expedition. Skeletons of 8 men, believed to be possibly those of the members of the Leichhardt expedition which left Moreton Bay 90 years ago to cross the continent from east to west, have been found in the Simpson Desert by Mr. Edwin Lowe and his son Rex of Dalhousie Springs and Mount Dare stations. Adelaide authorities were unanimous last night, this is the 3rd of August, in saying that an inspection by experts would be the only way of deciding the matter. They agreed that only an experienced anthropologist would be able to say whether the skeletons were those of whites or of natives. Announcing the finding of the skeletons in reply to a question by Mr. Duncan about a rumour that traces of the expedition had been found, the Chief Secretary, Sir George Ritchie, who was also the acting Premier, said in the Legislative Council yesterday afternoon that the station owner had called on him and told him of the discovery. Mr. Lowe reported to the Chief Secretary that he and his son had gone out into the Simpson Desert, about 80 miles northeast of Mount Dare Station, to muster cattle. They had found a camp of 7 skeletons grouped in a circle. It appeared the men had been around a campfire and had been surprised by blacks and speared. 2 miles away, he and his son had found another skeleton. That man had probably been wounded and had, in inverted commas, run for it. And then a little further down, the bones, with the exception of the shin bones, had been crumbled by the weather, but the teeth were intact, said Mr. Lowe. They, being the skeletons, were lying in a circle. The party would have struck the Fink River about 30 miles on and appeared to me to be trying to make for it. Mr. Lowe said that there was no doubt that the skeletons were those of white men. The teeth and the shape of the heads made that certain. So what you have is the unequivocal communication of the discovery of skeletons. And coming from an experienced bushman who lived in the area for decades, the idea that they couldn't be skeletons probably didn't enter anyone's head. They were accepted as skeletons. And there was, in the following 2 weeks, a steady flow of articles dealing not with the question of whether or not they were skeletons, but whether they were Aboriginal skeletons or European skeletons, and under what circumstance they had appeared. And here we come to the question of the sort of validation of this quite extraordinary communication. And I had half an inkling coming here today that it might be possible that Dr. Frank Fenner would be here, whose father was an esteemed geographer based in Adelaide, Charles Fenner, and a luminary in the Royal Geographical Society. And here we have an article in which Charles Fenner is invoking Ferdinand von Müller, who was one of the key protagonists in the theory that the expedition, the Leichhardt expedition, had met its end near the Cooper, or more specifically perhaps, certainly in South Australia, but in northern South Australia, but east of the telegraph line. This was von Müller's carefully formulated view. And Charles Fenner was quoted in the newspaper as suggesting that this was a reasonable inference. And coincidentally, it seems, next to that article, which takes up the 3 columns on the left, is a small single-column article suggesting that one of the key people who could be recommended for the expedition, given that the the results of the expedition would turn on the identification of the skeletal material was Adelaide's rising star of physical anthropology, Frank Fenner, who is with us today. And certainly from my own discussions with Norman Tyndale in previous years, he always, in his discussions of the growth and progression of South Australian anthropology during the 1930s, made this point that Frank Fenner was the person to see if you wanted any question of validation or authenticity relating to physical anthropology sorted out. So this entered the newspapers. The question still remained, though, in the public discourse, the discussion, and you can imagine it in Adelaide with this sort of rising excitement of this revelation, as to whether these could have been explorers sitting around a campfire, and how, after all, do you spear seven people sort of simultaneously so that their skeletons lie in a neat circle around a campfire? Or could they have been possibly Aboriginal cattle thieves who were assassinated? And that, yes, if you dug in the sand, you might find the bullets. And this is just one example that I found while browsing through the newspapers, and apologies for the quality, but this is a scan from a photocopy off a microfilm. It's extraordinary. Of a typical native night camp in the north, just to sort of add to the debate and illuminate it, perhaps. So the excitement grew, and here we have a picture in the centre there of a lunch attended among others by Frank Fenner, you may remember it, at St Mark's College, where Charles Fenner, I believe, was the master. And this is including the waitress and a big bowl of flowers. But this was the luncheon party, one of several, I believe. Another one was at Government House itself, which began to add to the excitement. And, of course, there were serious discussions about how the thing would unfold. And a lot of these discussions made their way back into the newspaper. And here, I think, is a photograph taken as the expedition party took shape, probably, I think, at St Mark's, where you have the main protagonists, from left to right, Sir George Ritchie, the acting premier, Grenfell Price, the leader. Sorry, I referred earlier to Charles Fenner being the master at St Mark's. I think he wasn't. I think it was Grenfell Price. Grenfell Price, the leader, C.P. Mountford, who was really the key ethnologist in Adelaide at that time because Tyndale was away. And I like to think that if Tyndale had been there, maybe the expedition would have taken a slightly different course, but that's all speculative. Then there was the Assistant Surveyor General. It was seen as very necessary as this expedition would be heading into more or less unmapped territory to have a senior surveyor there. And finally, the one who set it all moving, probably in the Black Bull Hotel, Edwin Lowe, the discoverer of the skeletons in inverted commas. Looking at the map. Now, this is a photograph which may bring some memories back for Frank Fenner, because this was seriously believed to be an extraordinary, unprecedented expedition for the recovery of the actual identified skeletons of the members of the Leichhardt Party. And with that in mind, the museum preparator knocked up some pine coffins. Maybe they're just boxes, but I like to think of them as coffins. And, of course, projecting forward, one can imagine a cortege through the streets of Adelaide even a little later. But maybe not, but it certainly it was judged that the skeletons could be dealt with individually, and this was the amount of preparation that went into it. Again, from the Mountford Journal. And then, with everything heading in that direction, and Frank Fenner almost aboard the expedition, came an inter-varsity hockey match on the, I believe, the Saturday preceding the departure, during which Frank's kneecap was cracked with a hockey stick, I imagine, and broken. He ended up in hospital. So with 2 days' notice, or possibly three, Adelaide's sort of senior physical anthropologist of the period, more of a dental anthropologist, which turned out to be very useful anyway, T.D. Campbell, stepped aboard. And he is there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, from the left. I don't know whether you can read the names there, but Grundy, the wireless operator on the left, and A.C. Kinnear, they were brought in to beam or flash the results of the discovery of the skeletons back to civilization. Again, an unprecedented development in expeditionary practice. Was to be duplicated the following year with the Madigan expedition, which took its own wireless operator to the Simpson Desert and broadcast from there. You have Smith, the surveyor, T.D. Campbell, C.E.P. Mountford, Grenfell Price, George Ritchie on his cane, and then an unnamed schoolboy whose name was actually Paul Thomas and who, believe it or not, went on the expedition. So this is a sort of Harry Potter moment for the expedition. Edwin Lowe and Reverend George Pierce. Is it? No, George Pierce. Yeah, I don't know quite how he fitted in. Yes, Paul Thomas was the friend of Edwin Lowe's son. So he came along at the last minute. Off they went. And this is a recently acquired map of the expedition donated among some of T.D. Campbell's papers by Bob Edwards with the signatures of the expedition members and a slip of paper which carried the name of it, which is unfortunately stuck to the map. It needs to be removed. But over on the far right, you can see a red cross against some transverse sandhills. And this is the very southwestern edge of the Simpson Desert. And the site is actually on the first major dune in the Simpson Desert, on Mount Dare Station. Over right onto the left is Abminga Station, which was the railway station, and from there the party took camels and horses across country to the Fink, which is the main river, down the Fink past its flood out area in the sand dunes, and then across the sand dune to this site. So that for various reasons the position of the find seemed to be significant and in a way reasonable and logical for Leichhardt on a certain trajectory to have come down to the Fink. Well, the evening after leaving Abminga Station, they camped 16 miles from the site of the skeletons, and this is the news story which was actually beamed back to Oodnadatta to the relay by Kinnear on the wireless, and it's full of the otherwise insignificant detail relating to this sense of building tension, knowing that the following day they would be looking at these skeletons. Well, the following day we have T.D. Campbell's account of that experience, and I'll read it to you. After an hour or so of riding at walking pace, we reached a fair-sized sandhill, and just over it was the goal of our great search. Again, we had to halt for a few minutes and then jog along in a ridiculous-looking line along the sandhill for the benefit of a movie shot. And I should tell you, if there's time at the end of this, I'll show you a few minutes of the movie that was taken. I was not feeling over cheerful, and this seemed to me to be a rather idiotic approach to an occasion and moment which turned out to be even more pathetic. So we descended the eastern slope of this big sandhill to gaze upon this, quote, ring of human skeletons about which we had heard and read so much, and over which the government, newspapers, Government House lunch, and interested friends had dispatched the party to examine and collect, to say nothing of the somewhat troubled and unwilling decision I'd made personally to come north and join the investigations. Led to the spot, we looked for this much-reported group of skeletal remains, and what a dismal scattering of whitish bits of material they were. A few moments were sufficient for me to decide that these remnants were not bone at all, but some sort of calcified wood material. This is one of the one of the photos. There were not many photos taken, actually. One of them. So Campbell was all for turning around immediately and going straight back to Abminga Station and cutting his losses and getting back to Adelaide. However, they brought all this equipment with them, and the following morning they settled in and established the sieving operations and began sieving the sandhill, essentially. It was rather hot and there were plenty of flies, and Campbell records all this in his journal. However, the extraordinary thing is that almost just within, well, within a few minutes of beginning, Lowe came up with some teeth fragments, human teeth fragments. So this was interesting. There really was something there. And then an hour later, an 1841 Maundy Thursday threepenny bit sieved out of the sandhill on the first morning. And Campbell wrote, sure enough, the date figures showed out quite clearly, you can't really see it clearly there, it's actually on the other side, 1841 was the year that Leichhardt left England. This find caused considerable excitement among the workers on the spot. Those back at camp would not believe me when I went back to camp and told them of the find. You can imagine the rate of digging increased significantly. They gridded out a 10 by 10 square metre section, and within the next few hours they did find what appears to be an iron pack saddle ring, a number of other teeth fragments which Campbell pronounced as being Aboriginal, and some steel fragments, as well as these pieces of leather, which they divided up into two categories, one being boot leather with a stitched upper here, or a sole, and then the saddle leather on the other side, an iron saddle ring, which was in the previous slide, I think. And some undeniably human bone fragments. The question is what to make of all this. Oh, and this is a wax preservation. I don't know what you call it. It's not really a cast, but it's a preservation of the calcified tree root, which, as Campbell put it, could somewhat resemble a thigh bone to a lay person. So he was sort of letting Mr. Lowe off the hook a little bit. Then later in the afternoon of the second day, extraordinary find of an 1817 half sovereign, which from the little indentation here, it appears to have been used as a pendant at some time. So all of this required explanation, and nobody in the expedition could provide it, nor could really anyone else in Adelaide. And nor, I think, has anyone satisfactorily since. This is Mountford's gridded diagram with the finds numbered and plotted on the right-hand side there. And the white squares are the positions of the so-called skeletons. I'll just read briefly Campbell's conclusions. Certain of the osseous material collected is definitely human, but there is no evidence available to say whether they belong to white man or Aboriginal. The tooth fragments appear definitely to be one of them, and at least one of an Aboriginal adult. Sternum bone from possibly an immature person. Artifacts and coins and rusted ring, so on. Stone implements found on the site suggested that at some time or other Aborigines had camped there. Finally, the recovery of objects of civilised manufacture suggests the site was also a campsite of white men, but there is no evidence to allow any assessment as to when these objects were deposited there. I would argue that the one conclusion that they didn't entertain, and which they could and which we could too, is that this was actually an Aboriginal burial that they were looking at, and that the bits of metal and the bits of leather and so on were not uncharacteristic of Aboriginal burials in the contact period, where these accumulated pieces, all with their own, one could say, talismanic qualities, could be incorporated in burials, and this is well documented across Australia. It didn't seem to occur to any of them. I think it would have occurred to Tyndale if he'd been involved in the excavation.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.